A few months ago in the spring, we asked the landscape designer Daryl Lindsay to offer some ideas for the beginning of the growing season, and not just mention flowers and shrubs that look good, but that make sense for this climate. Lindsay insists you can create a verdant, cooling landscape in the arid West, but you have to understand native plants and how soil and microclimates work. And all of this is personal to her, as you can tell when you hear her story, because plants are her, I don't know, her thing, you know, her passion, her calling. But it didn't start out that way.
Way back when I studied journalism, I worked as a digital reporter at KUTV. Loved it, actually, but, you know, had a mortgage, needed to make some money. So I went to work at an ad agency, and then I was the marketing manager at Brighton Resort. Loved it. And then just thought, you know, time to level up, get a promotion, get an office. You know, so I moved to another resort that shall remain nameless, with a bigger title and my own office with a door that shut. And I thought that was just the thing to do. And I was miserable. I regretted my decision every minute of every day. And the majority of that did come from the fact that I didn't know what was going on with me or my brain. Like, I didn't know that I had autism. I didn't know that I had ADHD. And I had been kind of white-knuckling it through my existence prior to that by just forcing my way through it, and it was hard, but I didn't realize until I was genuinely exhausted, burned out, and unhappy how acute the issues could become, and that sort of brought it to a head. I started getting insane chronic migraines that would level me for days and days, and I had never had that before. And I eventually learned that when you're masking, which is when you're basically putting on a front and performing like a neurotypical person, there's all this tension that I feel in my jaw and the back of my neck and my shoulders. And I was doing that so many hours of the day that I was giving myself these impossible headaches. And it was making me sick. I was literally getting sick. So then it was a day where I had spent the whole day trying so hard to get, I think it was a slide deck. It was something that felt so meaningless to me. When you're doing a slide deck about luxury hospitality. And every time I sent in an edit, the feedback was so cryptic and difficult to understand. Just, you know, 8+, 9+ hours of doing that and feeling so defeated, and then also feeling so defeated over something that I didn't even think mattered. And I just had this moment where I burst into tears. So I took out my phone and I snapped a photo and I texted it to my best friend and I just said, I think I hate my job. And I had never hated my job before. I've always excelled at what I've done. And the idea of hating my job in itself was a failure. It felt like such a crushing failure because I had made this wrong decision. And I had all sorts of ideas of how I was going to get myself out of that situation, but I was trying to just put my head down and hold on, and I'd look for other jobs or I'd figure it out. But I started to have this crisis of, is this even what I want to be doing? And that was such a different experience for me because I had never hated my job before. I've always been a deeply creative person, a deeply productive person. And I was in this time of my life where I could not create and have it be met successfully. And so I started just posting online about the little things in life that made me happy, most of which was vegetable gardening. So I'd be out in my garden taking photos of squash and filming little videos about harvesting the squash blossoms and frying them up to make lunch. And that started to gain a little bit of traction. I wouldn't say it blew up, but at least I was having these moments of joy in my day-to-day life. And it was actually my hairstylist who first asked me while I was in the chair, hey, could you design my yard for me? And I said, absolutely. And because of my digital marketing background, I had never rendered a landscape design before, but I figured out how to Photoshop a 3D rendering of a yard together. And I posted it and immediately had 10 emails in my inbox. Didn't have a website, nothing, just 10 emails from people who had seen the post and said, hey, could you do this for me too? And so I said, sure, let's do like an hour virtual call. I set up a Calendly link and then it was just full speed ahead for the next 2 years.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Daryl Lindsay is with us today talking about yards and gardens in this part of the West. She's a sustainable landscape designer who is certified in rainwater harvesting and permaculture. She's the founder of Yard Farmer. It's a sustainable design studio, and she has a really cool presence on social media. Now, this may not seem as exciting a conversation as in the spring, but Lindsay told us August can tell you things about plants.
I'm thinking about climate resiliency in yards, in landscaping in general, because especially this July and August, we're seeing so much more of that heat and drought that we used to have. I think we were a bit spoiled the last couple of years with more mild springs, more rainy summers. Yeah. And so the landscapes held together better. And so now I'm thinking a lot about when you do this planting, be it a fresh landscape that you've installed this year or an established landscape that's 5 or 10 years old, how are you making your landscape survive this period without just dumping an irresponsible amount of water on it, which obviously we're trying not to do.
Yep.
So there's a lot of different ways to go about that, be it what you choose to plant, or even if you have existing Kentucky bluegrass, how you manage that Kentucky bluegrass to both have it look better and also require fewer resources.
And that's on your mind now because you're driving around and you're seeing that thing is dying. Yeah. That clump is not thriving.
Yeah. And as folks try to do the right thing and scale their water use back, their Kentucky bluegrass is going dormant and field bindweed is moving in because field bindweed doesn't need the water, but the bluegrass does. Huh. And so I'm seeing, you know, brown, crispy grass overtaken by field bindweed. And I'm like, we could do better than this, but I also don't want to see a golf course for a front lawn in Salt Lake City in August because that's its own kind of distressing to me to witness.
Yeah.
So how do we make a typical traditional yard more resilient to this kind of heat, this kind of drought, but also if we are going to make those conversions and make smarter choices away?
Because in August is when it reveals itself as whether it's successful.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And a lot of those beautiful spring ephemerals, they're gone.
Yep.
Even things like your yarrow and your penstemon, your beautiful native flowering plants, those are starting to get really crispy.
Yeah.
I would love to see more fall blooming plants in landscapes, especially because a lot of our critically endangered native pollinators need those food sources into the fall. Things like aster and goldenrod that bloom late in the summer into the fall are actually really important food sources for monarch butterflies, for example. Everybody talks about milkweed, but that's just for the caterpillars. Once they're actually butterflies, what are they going to eat?
Yeah.
What are they going to eat?
Right.
So I would like to see more of that staggering of bloom times in order to support native wildlife as well. But yeah, August is just the moment where I really start to see that pinch point, that critical point of like, if we want things to look good and we want to save the planet, what steps are we taking to get there?
Okay, so on that point, so this is something you've talked about. It's time we have a conversation about what climate resilience actually looks like in a landscape. So give us a sense. What does it look like in a landscape? Just it's that it's surviving. And also give us a sense of – I'm not asking for you to predict how hot it's going to be in 2035 or whatever, but clearly you are thinking about a pattern that we ought to have in mind. So how are you thinking about that?
There's actually some really interesting conversations happening about now where we are thinking about planning for 2035 or 2050. And we have – data. There are data scientists doing this that are saying this is probably around the temperature range we can expect in the future. And we are looking to plant things where those plants can withstand those future temperatures as well as the current temperatures. I would love to say just do a 100% Utah native plant palette and you'll be fine. But there's a lot of nuances to that because in Utah, we have St. George, we have Salt Lake City in the valley, we have Park City and beyond, and those native plants require distinctly different microclimates and water.
And does any yard have a kind of a microclimate?
Yes.
Okay, we're going to get to that because I want to talk more about that. But yeah, so that's what we need to be thinking of, I suppose.
Yeah, so there's that, planting things that can withstand extreme swings in temperature.
Yeah.
planting native things that can withstand extreme swings in temperature. Because what I don't want people to do is say, oh, the USDA says that we're now zone 7 point this instead of 6 point that. I can plant a magnolia. Yeah. We will still get extreme swings of temperature to the cold, and that magnolia will probably kick the bucket at that point. So you still want to plant native things that can withstand extreme heat as well as extreme cold.
Yeah, because it's 15 degrees in February or whatever.
Climate change can bring both extremes. We also then want to think about how we could improve the drought tolerance of those plants once you plant them. And there are fascinating steps that can be taken there as far as what we amend the soil with, the types of relationships that we encourage the roots of those plants to have with bacteria and fungi.
Oh, you so want to talk about biochar, don't you?
I do. I really do, but I won't unless you want me to.
We will later, or maybe.
Yeah. But really, I want to talk about mycorrhizal fungi. Biochar can be a nice vehicle to get there, but at the end of the day, we need a living food web in our soil, and we need soil structure that isn't just a bunch of clay and salt stacked on top of each other that we then spray with chemicals, and then we put landscape fabric on top of it, and then we spray that with chemicals. There's no life in that soil.
And put a pin in that because I want to come back to that. Let me ask you about something. Responsible amount of water, right? One of the things you've said to us is, like, look, we'd all love our yards to look like a botanical garden. But there are only a few smart ways to actually do that responsibly. So what is too much? Like, what does it mean to be wasteful? Is it something you can, like, actually measure? And do you think – should we be thinking about it as, like, okay, here's my – share, whether that's an actual number or whether we're thinking in terms of how much space we – I mean, how do you think about that?
Stephanie Dewar would tell you. She's got a GIS map and she knows how much water you're using and she knows how much water I'm using.
Yeah, yeah.
And she would argue almost all of it is too much.
Yeah.
What's interesting about that is that we know that the amount of water that can benefit, let's just say, Kentucky bluegrass, yes, it goes up exponentially and then it plateaus. So there is a max amount that you can water Kentucky bluegrass, and the majority, this is according to Stephanie Dewar, you'll have to follow up with her for the fact checking, but according to her, there is a plateau, and the majority of residents in Salt Lake City are well above the plateau. And that is wild to me when 50 to 60% of potable water in the western United States goes to outdoor irrigation. Like, that's drinkable water that we are wasting. And when you ask what I'm thinking about in August when it's this hot and this dry and we get 5 droplets of rain and I'm standing outside just like, please, please, sir, may I have some more? Right? I'm thinking about that.
Yeah.
So I don't want to tell people here, I don't want to look them in the eyes and say, don't use culinary water to water your lawn. Most people, that's what we have.
Yeah.
But I want to reduce the amount. I also want to make sure that our rainwater is doing something valuable on the property. And that does not mean just putting 50 gallons of rainwater into a plastic tank and then using that somehow. The average roof is harvesting 10 to 20,000 gallons of water per roof in Salt Lake per year. I think it might actually be more than that now that I'm thinking about it. But we get 22 inches of rain a year in Utah, and 1,000 square feet of roof can harvest 600 gallons of water per inch of rain. And we get 22, and that doesn't count for snow melt either. And that water is going to a storm drain, and I don't necessarily know all the nuances there because I think it still does go through various processes and end up in the Jordan River Canal and the Great Salt Lake, so it's not the end of the world. But it's an inefficient way to cycle our water through the system because we're sending that water to the storm drain, and then we're paying to bring someone else's water back, and we're bringing more on than we're sending off.
Yeah.
So I would like to close that loop a little bit. And if we are going to bring water on, greatly reduce that amount and use what we have first, because what we'll end up seeing is a net positive in terms of the amount of water we can conserve. So if we're not doing a 50-gallon rain barrel at the bottom of a downspout, which you can do if you want to use that for your squash, That rain barrel needs to overflow, or that downspout needs to be directed into your landscape, and you need to grade your landscape so that it doesn't run off. And you can do that by digging basins or swales. Some people call them rain gardens, but it truly could be that your flower bed is just 6 inches lower than it currently is, so that the water kind of pools there and then percolates down rather than running off. And I'm sure people have seen this. Like if there's just a big patch of bare dirt and there's a tire tread in it and all the weeds are just growing in the tire tread, it's because that's where the water pools.
Yeah.
And so if we plant native plants that are adapted to our rainfall and they're adapted to our dryout periods and the water pools there and percolates there, those native plants can subsist off of very little supplemental irrigation. I'm talking very little, if not none, because they might go a little dormant in August when it's really dry and hasn't rained in a couple months, but then we're going to get a big flush of rain and it's going to percolate and those plants will put out a huge flush of growth. And if you really didn't want them to get crispy, you could point your hose at that 6-inch swale that you just dug and it would simulate a rainstorm and you
still hold it in.
Yeah. And now you've used 30 gallons of water instead of the hundreds of thousands of gallons of water per year that each household in Salt Lake City averages. That's what I'm thinking about.
Yeah. When you talk about native plants, it makes me think about something that I was thinking about, how you would translate like the plant language that some of us have when we look at, you know, an Instagram account from Maine or Vermont or the humid South, right? How would you translate that language if you have in mind something beautiful from that you want to make happen in your space, but you're in Utah. So how would you translate that look to this place, or should you be thinking about it like that?
I think it's perfectly acceptable and normal, and it's going to happen where we look at a beautiful photo from somewhere else and we want to channel that aesthetic or that energy into our space.
Yeah.
I do think we need to apply some critical thought to not just using it like a one-to-one recipe.
Right.
Not just saying, okay, they're using hydrangeas and lavender, I should use hydrangeas and lavender. And so a lot of times I'll ask a client, what kind of plants do you like, or what kind of general colors or textures do you like? And they'll say, I really like lavender. And I'd say, okay, great. We have a Rocky Mountain penstemon that also has a gorgeous purple flush of flowers on a long green stem.
Yeah.
We can channel that look for you without having to use the non-native plant. So I'd say absorb what you like about that photo from Maine or Vermont, and then look for analogs here that are better adapted to your situation.
Daryl Lindsay, she's a landscape designer, founder of Yard Farmer. It's a sustainable design studio. You should check out her social media presence. We'll put a link to all the things on our website. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have back with us the landscape designer, Daryl Lindsay. And we're talking about your yard in August in Utah. And it seems like the worst part of the growing season, but we've been talking about how people can translate their garden fantasies into something realistic for this place. Okay, so one of the things that I was thinking about is how you would translate, I think this is how you've put it before, the plant language you have of some other place to this place. So like if you have in mind a beautiful English garden or a southern garden or some really verdant, you know, botanical garden in Maine, right? How would you translate that look to this place? And one of the things you've said is that it's important to identify what sort of aesthetic you want to embody. So maybe say something about that before we get to translating a kind of one-to-one swap, because I do want to ask you about that.
Yeah, I mean, landscape design, at the end of the day, it's just like any other form of design in which it's storytelling. Huh. And so if somebody wants a certain look and aesthetic, or they ask for a certain plant, what I'm trying to interpret is what are they actually asking for? And they're asking for a story.
Yeah.
They're asking for a certain aesthetic to be met. And so if you want a boxwood, you might want a traditional English garden, a formal English garden that you might see at one of those great manor houses.
Yeah, yeah.
And so how do we translate that energy into a Utah native landscape without having to use those one-to-one plants? And there's nuance there, because I love that you're taking inspiration from that image, but we can't just use it as a recipe where we're saying boxwood plus lavender plus cosmos equals cottage garden. That works if you're okay with being 100% non-native and therefore much less water-wise. But if we want to translate that for Utah, we need to find analog plants. We need to find something that kind of matches and tells the story.
Yeah.
Even if it's not identical, would the sum of all of those parts do what we need it to do?
So you're saying it's okay to have the story. You have to be realistic about where you live.
Yeah.
It's different from Surrey, England, right? But it's okay to have that story. It's okay to fantasize a little. We just have to be real.
I have a client, and I actually can find this conceptual draft for you if you want to see it or put it somewhere. But I have a client who's 27 years old. We got on for our first virtual consultation. She was wearing a black lace choker with a big ruby on it. Fair skin, pitch black hair. I said, what kind of aesthetic, what kind of story do you want to tell? And she literally said, look at me.
Yeah.
She said, look at me. And we told the story both through the hardscape selections that we made and also the planting selections that we made, in that she got a romantic, gothic, Victorian English garden in Hiram, Utah.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so how we did that with the hardscaping, we did a black and white harlequin or checkerboard floor by doing black gravel interlocked with just one by one white concrete pavers from Home Depot. And it creates that chessboard black and white look in the hardscaping. And then we actually created, you know, when those boxwoods wrap a garden just in a perfect circle and then you have all the wild stuff in there? We used a stone crop, which is a sedum. It's closely related to a succulent. It's incredibly drought tolerant. There's one called Night Embers Stone Crop. It is literally black burgundy. And we used that, you know, that texture of a succulent where you have that kind of firmness.
Yeah.
It's not a boxwood, but it's telling the story. We planted 20 of those in a circle around the herbaceous wild stuff and mimicked boxwoods. And it's not going to lie, it's one of the favorite, one of the my most favorite planting designs we've ever done as a studio. So we have to identify the essence.
Yeah.
We do joke. This is a joke, but honestly, it's very serious. That at our studio, my job is vibes, because now we have landscape architects and project managers and people who have master's degrees in this working for my studio, and I'm just here. And my job is vibes. And really it is. It's listening to a client speak about what they like and pulling from that, what story are we trying to tell with the planting design?
So let me make what may be a kind of a lame comparison to you being like a hair stylist in this sense. When I was a kid, I would look through magazines and you would find a celebrity and you're like, that hairstyle is so cool. And I would cut it out and you'd go to the hairstylist and you'd say, do this. And they would either try to do that or they would be honest with you and say, dude, your hair is super curly. You can't pull that off. That's not going to work. Let's find something that, in your words, tells the same kind of story. Is it kind of like that?
It's absolutely like that.
Yeah.
It's understanding that there's what a client is asking for, and then there's what a client is really asking for, which they may not have the language to articulate.
Yeah.
And I think it's honestly does everyone a disservice to expect a client to learn all of that language when it's our job to reach past that. So a lot of times a client would come in and say, I think I want to do a dry riverbed here. And I actually really dislike dry riverbeds in landscapes because, like with all we've talked about passive rainwater harvesting, why are we making all of the water pool on top of a bunch of rocks where nothing is growing?
Yeah.
And then you end up just pulling weeds out of that dry riverbed if you want it to keep looking like a dry riverbed. So when I hear a client ask for that, What I'm actually hearing is, okay, we want some interesting topography. Yeah. We want something that draws the eye and like a ribbon through the landscape. We want something more visual than just some flowers and some grass. And then I start exploring those options with them. And usually we land on something that both ticks that box for them and also is practical and low maintenance and ecological and all of the things that I want it to be.
Okay, so let's do this. Let's try and do a one-to-one swap. And let me go through a few
things. Pop quiz.
Okay, pop quiz. Japanese maple. People love them. They do look great. Do they belong here?
If somebody has a Japanese maple in their yard and they love it and it's doing well, I'm not going to rip it out.
Yeah.
But maybe it's usually not doing well, and especially if it's in full sun on the western side of the house with a white wall. We've talked about it.
Right.
If we can move it to the shade, great. If we cannot, we need to channel the story of a Japanese maple without it being a Japanese maple.
Right.
There are elderberry shrubs or cultivars of elderberry shrubs that have a very similar lacy leaf texture as a Japanese maple. And the black lace elderberry actually has a deep, moody burgundy color. It's not quite the same ruby red, but again, we're just channeling the vibes.
Yeah.
And that is going to do a lot better in Utah than a Japanese maple is.
Okay. A lot of people like, you know, they're thinking of Harvard or Cambridge or Brown or whatever. You know, like they like ivy. They like vines. That's a cool vibe. What's the translation?
Yeah, please don't plant English ivy intentionally. And it's crazy to me that you can still go to Home Depot or Lowe's and buy English ivy from the store. It's so incredibly invasive here. It kills trees. It chokes out ecosystems. Let's not do it. If you had to have ivy, maybe we could do a Boston ivy. At least it's native to the United States, but not this side of the United States. Virginia creeper, usually people aren't planting it on purpose because it is aggressive and it's everywhere, but it is native closer to here. So again, I hate that less and I'll rip that out less often. Usually when I see ivy, I say it has to go. We have native vines that are wonderful and ecological. They're a little harder to find. They might be a little harder to get started. But if we can do it, if the site, if it's the right plant for the right place, Western white clematis, native, gorgeous. We even have native wild grapes. There's a California wild grape that is actually native as far as here into the Rocky Mountain region. So if the goal is just you want a beautiful structure with vines climbing on it, we do not have to resort to ivy first.
Okay. In a place that can be pretty dry, like Utah, I get surprised when people talk about moss or something really, really green that's clinging to stones, you know, and pathways and stuff like that. But people like it.
Because they see photos from Ireland.
For sure. Right. Exactly. So can they tell that story here?
They sure can.
Okay.
So you see creeping thyme a lot.
Yeah.
It's not native. It's lovely growing in between flagstones and a pathway. I would still plant it if somebody really wanted that look. It's not invasive. You see it at the Conservation Garden Park, all of those things. However, there are some fun, even more native options in the sedum family, where if you're really going for that mossy, magical, some might say cottagecore look, there are creeping sedums and even creeping sedums where the name of them is Utah sedum. It's native to here, and it looks like moss because it has all of that texture, that bumpy texture, bright green, almost chartreuse color, creeping, mat-forming habit. Grow that in between your flagstones. It's fabulous.
All right, forsythia. That comes up a lot.
Folks love forsythia because it has these bright, almost neon yellow flowers in the spring. And I admit, I love a pop of color in the spring when you're just desperate for anything to be blooming. What I find amazing is that Oregon grape, which we've talked about, Oregon grape has the exact same color of flower. And when those plants are healthy and happy, that shrub is covered in that neon yellow color. And they bloom at the exact same time. So you could see a forsythia and an Oregon grape planted next to each other. Oregon grape has different texture on the leaves, but those flowers that come up at that time of year, it's a one-to-one match as far as color is concerned.
Is it... Oregon grape, any of the ones that you just mentioned, are they hard to get at garden stores? Like when you go there, are they available or are people going to have to really look for this stuff?
Most of them are easy enough to get.
Okay.
Oregon grape, definitely possible to get.
Sure.
Western white clematis, I have had trouble finding. I've ordered it online before and had it shipped in just a little baby bind. And that's why I was saying it might take longer to start because you might have to order something and have it brought in by mail.
I guess the question is, are garden stores tuned in to native plants like they should
Way
be?
Way less than they should be.
Okay.
It's killing me. I'm lucky to have met some amazing nurseries. I will shout them out here. Twin Pines Nursery in Sandy is doing well as far as natives go. And there's also Cache Valley Native Plants way up in Cache Valley. But I've established a great relationship with her, Katie, and she will ship plants down to me. She'll drive them down to me and my clients. And we'll even do farmers market days and things down here to get more plants in the hands of folks. So check those out if you're specifically looking for natives. But at the end of the day, like, you can order something if you can't find it, as long as you know what to look for.
Let me come back to the personal part of your story. And I want to maybe we can get some of the language out of the way. You hear people described as being on the spectrum. You hear people described as being high functioning or low functioning. Tell me about – because I want to get to how your brain informs – the way you see the world, the way you design a landscape, the way you think about all of this. But I want to get the language part out of the way and how you're thinking about it.
Absolutely.
How do you think about where you are on this continuum and how we should be talking about it?
Yeah, I definitely don't think of it as a spectrum between more autistic and less autistic. And I do think there are some really interesting conversations happening now about the word functioning. And I don't love the word, to be honest, because what does that mean? What does that mean? I'd say I am an autistic person with pretty low support needs generally until they're not, until my support needs really go up, and sometimes they do. Yesterday was one such day. It happens. I think of autism as a wheel or maybe many, many, many spectrums with 100 different traits on them, where any person might have more or less of one of these things, be it like executive function, for example. Sometimes I have a lot of it. Sometimes I have absolutely no executive function. You ask me what I want for dinner and tears will spring into my eyes. Overstimulation or sensory issues. If something is touching the back of my neck that I don't want to be touching, like, it could ruin my day, for example. Yeah. There are 100 different things like that. And with that come the things that some people consider superpowers, quote unquote. And I wish that people could see the face that I'm making when I say that because –
it's the air quotes version of that. Yeah.
The air quotes version, because I think it's a little condescending to just be like, but you're so good at piano or you're so good at math. And, you know.
And if I dropped these matchsticks, you could count them. And
The media representation of what it means.
Right.
But I do have, I believe, to quote my therapist, extremely high spatial intelligence. That's how she described it. Where I can walk into a space and someone says, I want this, this, and this, I can see it. Yeah. And so that's why when I was looking to career change and my hairstylist asked me if I could design her yard, I saw it. I photoshopped it. No design degree was had at that point. I have certifications now. And it worked, right? And yes, I have my brain to thank for that.
Do you have a design philosophy?
That is a very interesting question. I should warn you, one of my autistic traits is that I always ask for context, so I really know what you're asking.
Okay. I guess what I'm thinking of is there a designer that you have followed who says something quippy or wise? Minimalism, maximalism, simplify, edit. Are you guided by anything like that?
That is a fascinating question. What is interesting is I think the baseline that we hear all the time for ecological landscape design is right plants, right plant, right place.
Yeah.
I think I even used those words a little bit earlier, and it is about selecting the right plant for the correct microclimate.
Right.
But I break my own rules all the time. And so if I were to synthesize what the order is of if you were to come to me and say, design my yard for me, and I need to ask you all of those follow-up questions, like what for? What are we doing? I'm not just going to throw plants at you.
Yeah.
First thing would be, who's living in the house and who's using the yard? And what are you using each of these spaces for? And we'd go through each space one by one. Then I want to know about the pain points of the space because we use design to solve problems. And so I need to know if the nosy neighbor is to the west or the east. And I need to know, like, if you can't sit on your patio and have a drink at the end of the night because it's so hot. And I need to know if there's a weird smell or a weird noise, because we can use design to solve all of those problems.
Yeah.
So I actually have a section of my consultations where I open the floor to my clients to complain. And we call it landscaping therapy. And I just want them to vent, and I'll take notes and I pick out the patterns of the problems that need to be solved. I then ask, just in your ideal world, what activities do you want to be doing in your yard? What are those bullet points of your must-haves? But I do not let my clients place them. Mm-hmm. Because so often, someone's like, I think I want to do a dry riverbed over here.
Yeah.
And I want to do a garden box over there. And I always have to be like, why though? Is it because you thought it once and now you've trapped yourself into having that plan? And now we can't make other more dynamic decisions because we've already locked ourselves in to other plans. So I just say, give me the list, but we're just bullet pointing. We're not designing anything yet.
Right.
I take that information, set it to the side once I've asked the questions. I also have some boring questions I have to ask, like, where is your gas line buried and stuff, so that I don't tell you to put a tree on top of it. Then I set that to the side, and we do layout planning first. And so we do patios and pathways and lawn and vegetable garden and the things that humans and perhaps pets would be interacting with in the space before we ever talk about plants. Mm-hmm. Because the plants go everywhere else.
Yeah.
And there is a type of landscape design that I not so lovingly call boomerscaping, where I'm, and you've seen it. You've seen it. There's grass, and then there's a concrete curbing that goes... You can't see me, but I am wiggling my hands around.
Yeah.
It goes like this. Yeah. And then there's like petunias and begonias in a little row. What is the function of that wiggly space on the other side of that bed? Because they designed the plants first. They said, I want a landscape bed against this fence. Here's my squiggly landscape bed line. I'm going to put some concrete curbing down for some reason because it's 1997. And then I'm going to fill it with plants. And instead, I want a client to walk onto their beautiful back patio that meets all of their entertaining needs. And then I want them to take a path to their vegetable garden and cross over to their big, beautiful lawn where their children and their dogs are running around. And then the shed where the lawnmower is stored is right adjacent to that. And the play structure for the kids is running out onto the lawn.
Yeah.
And then I invert those shapes, and native plants go literally everywhere else. And that's how I design yards.
Let's talk about your own yard. Because I suppose years of thinking about this, you know, you're sort of transforming your own space. I don't know how much you want to talk about this or can, but let's talk about your own space, how you're thinking about what you're doing.
Sure. I'm redoing my front yard after many years of feeling guilty for not doing it. And it was getting to the point where a client would say, hey, could I drop off a present for you? And I'm like, no. You can't see what my own yard looks like. Absolutely not. Because, I mean, you do something all day for work and you don't want to come home and do it yourself. So I'm a bit behind on my own space.
Yeah.
But this year I just said, I'm going to do it. I designed it. I passed it off to some lovely contractors who are helping me do the work while I'm at work all day. I'm doing a sort of cottagey, whimsical front yard where you walk up a big flagstone path, and then there's going to be about 130 pollinator plants just in this little 800 square foot square.
Wow.
To the left and the right of the path. I'm doing a little bit of that passive rainwater harvesting I walked you through earlier.
How much grass?
Did I say grass?
No. How much? I'm wondering.
Oh, there is a 10 by 10 square of grass, not for any sort of front lawn reason, but because I am adjacent to an area where there are a lot of dogs. Mm. And I'm actually designing in a little dog park on the corner, and there's going to be a bench and a and a little thing for the waste bags and a little doggy bowl. And I literally tied in a hose bib so I can go fill up the doggy bowl with the water. Function, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So how what kind of incentives are there for people who want to do this? How are you thinking about expense, not just for the work you designed, but for people who want to try it themselves or try other designers? Are there still incentives in place for sticking with the old ways? Like what's out there? How are you assessing the
Utah Water Savers is a phenomenal program. It's in its second year. It's been a huge success, in my opinion. It's a $3 per square foot, or I should say up to $3 a square foot rebate that many municipalities are giving out to swap out their grass. I wish every city was participating. Unfortunately, they're not, but a very good portion of them are. I'd say I'm starting to become more surprised when I look up a client's city to see if they're eligible when they're not eligible. Because a lot of cities are participating. $3 a square foot is not going to get you, you know, if you rip out a bunch of Kentucky bluegrass, it's not going to get you custom flagstone and a waterfall and, you know, this dream yard. You're definitely still going to be spending money on top of that.
Yeah.
However, for clients who are on a budget and are looking for economical ways to flip their yard, $3 a square foot can get them most of the way there if they're looking to do the work themselves. Because you can remove your grass on your own, bring in some compost, bring in some mulch. You could use other state-run programs to get a bunch of free plants. We could talk about those programs as well. Or you could start buying some perennials and wait for them to get mature, and you could divide those and create more free plants out of free plants. You could do it for under $3 a square foot if you were willing to put in the elbow grease yourself. But if you want to pay a contractor, do it like I unfortunately have to now because I'm tired. It's probably more like $6, $7, $8 a square foot that you're going to spend, likely, if you're paying for labor.
Yeah.
And so $3 will really help.
Yeah.
It'll offset that cost.
Daryl Lindsay, she's a sustainable landscape designer, founder of Yard Farmer, an ecological design studio. You can catch her videos about gardening on TikTok and Instagram at yardfarmer.co. We'll take another break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The sustainable landscape designer Daryl Lindsay is back with us today. And she says, think of your yard as telling a story, but you need to try and tell it with native plants. Back now to our conversation. Okay, I want to come back to mycorrhizal
fungi.
Because it seems like you're as excited about this as anything else.
I love dirt.
You love your dirt. Talk about this.
Yeah.
What is it and how does it work? And yeah, explain.
Mycorrhizal fungi is believe it or not, Doug, mycorrhizal fungi is a type of fungi, but it's a symbiotic fungi. It forms a symbiotic relationship with plant roots. And because roots put out something, it's called exudates. And I think if I were to give you a metaphor for what exudates were, it's like sweat on human skin. It's the stuff that comes out of the roots. And the mycorrhizal fungi eat that. And in exchange, the mycorrhizal fungi have, I don't know how to describe it, but they put out, I'm not a scientist, they put out nodules
yeah.
that increase the plant's ability to uptake water and nutrients. And so when a plant has successful mycorrhizal fungal relationships, they uptake 100 times more water. Not 100% more, 100 times more water. And so that's why when you ask, how are we thinking about making plants more drought tolerant? I'm thinking, how do we get this soil to really be alive? And there are a lot of different steps that have to happen to make your soil as nature intended it to be, and not the way that we're constantly disturbing and damaging and disturbing and damaging and just hoping for the best over and over again. We need to stop spraying it with chemicals. Hmm. We need to stop putting plastic landscape fabric on top of it. Hmm. Think about a forest floor and the leaves drop at the end of the season, those leaves turn into more dirt and the cycle of soil building continues. We're putting literally just a layer of plastic in the middle of that cycle and completely stopping it from doing what it needs to do. And worst of all, people think it's going to suppress weeds, but it only suppresses one season of weeds. And next season, a bird is going to bring a different weed, yeah. Or the wind is going to bring a different weed. And we're back where we started, except now our soil's less prepared to make things we actually want to grow thrive.
What else can you do to make it healthy?
Plant native plants.
Okay.
Deep, healthy, mature root systems. And a native grass will have a root system that's 6 feet deep. And that grass will form. Yeah. So you want to think about how that plant can access the water table.
Yeah.
And access even just insulated, nice, damp soil down there versus Kentucky bluegrass, where the root length is directly correlated to the blade length. And if you mow it to be half an inch tall, your roots are half an inch deep. And that's not... That's why you have to drown your lawn to keep it alive. So yeah, planting dense perennial plantings where these roots live year-round. They go dormant sometimes. And those roots have successful mycorrhizal fungal relationships. And yes, you can purchase fungal inoculants that you could inoculate your roots with or your seeds with, and that would help. But honestly, nature kind of shows up when you plant those things. So if you encourage a native landscape, a native ecosystem, like those fungi are going to be there after a while. You don't have to go purchase something.
What should people be doing right now? People are thinking about plants and planting and like what do you say this is what you should be thinking about in August?
If you are wanting to flip your landscape from a regular landscape, if you're wanting to do a whole overhaul, I should say, you should start thinking about that now for next year. The contractors are booked out through the end of the summer. So start that conversation now. It's better to be ahead of the game than like trying to rush. Also, think about low-hanging fruit for water conservation and making your yard more resilient. So maybe it is biochar. Doug, maybe it is bringing in something that can help amend your soil and help it hold on to water. Even a layer of wood mulch on top can be sort of a slow release sponge because you think about the way that wood would absorb water and hold on to it. Think about raising that setting on your lawn. I would like everybody listening to this to please do that.
Go, put it on pause and go and do this right now.
Go do it right now.
Yeah.
It depends on if you're just trying to retrofit your existing infrastructure or you're trying to do something new. But in August specifically, I would audit your systems for see what's failing. Go outside, see what didn't make it, what couldn't survive the drought, and then ask yourself why. And it's probably not just because, or maybe it is just because it didn't get enough water, but was it the wrong plant for that Western-facing aspect with the White House reflecting on, was it the wrong plant choice? Was there landscape fabric underneath and surface-level roots had formed so the roots couldn't get down under it? Ask yourself those questions so that then when you go to either retrofit or completely redo, you can correct. I think now's a great time for observation.
I want to ask you this finally. Are you feeling like... I don't know quite how to put it, the culture, the sentiment about native plants and, living sustainably and choosing the right plants for the right space and right microclimate. Are you seeing that changing in a good way, or what are you noticing about all of that?
I do. I think it's entering the mainstream. I don't know if it's quite mainstream, but I do think it's starting to enter the mainstream where more people are becoming aware of this.
Yeah.
If not 100% native landscapes and pollinator habitat, if we're not going all the way over there, then at least how do I plant something besides bluegrass? I think that conversation is a lot more mainstream than it was even two, three, 4 years ago.
And that makes you happy.
Oh, of course. And busy.
Daryl, thanks.
Hey, thanks.
It's Daryl Lindsay. She's a sustainable landscape designer. You can catch her videos about gardening on TikTok and Instagram at yardfarmer.co. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And we're on YouTube at KUER 90.1. As always, we'd love to hear from you. You can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.